you know, develop a device which meets market demand. And market demand is watching video at the moment. How many people actually make phone calls
watching
nowadays?
Porn in India, apparently.
Was it?
You know, India's levels of data traffic since Jio came in and said you can have it for free have like spiked, and there's an article in The Economist this week that basically it's all porn. It's basically Indian guys on buses.
I'm so shocked.
And they would do it in public places, they just watch porn videos.
Damn.
So
hello and welcome to a long overdue telecoms.com podcast. Sorry for not doing one sooner. It's mainly because Pierre couldn't be bothered to turn up.
There we go.
I am joined as well as by Pierre with Jamie and Ian, as usual. And just as a reminder that if you're listening to this on SoundCloud or iTunes, you can watch it on the website or YouTube and vice versa. You can listen to
Facebook.
It on stuff. Good. Right, what are we going to chat about? So we have delayed long enough for it to be the start of earnings season. So I guess that's what we're going to talk about. We were writing about Ericsson's numbers today. Jamie, you were writing about Vodafone's numbers. And I think all that stuff moves us into some of the other fun things that have been happening to start the year, especially with Huawei. We're going to talk about Huawei getting aggro from various countries for a change. That's never come up, has it? So I'll start off by talking about Ericsson's quarterlies. Not incredibly exciting, just sort of solid. They've had three quarters in a row of solid, which they'll take, because they had about 20 quarters of not so solid prior to that. This being their Q4, they also managed to register their full year, and this is the full year in which they've actually managed revenue growth since the first full year since 2013, isn't it?
Yeah.
Only 1%, but you know.
Organic, anyway.
Yeah, organic, yeah, adjusted. Yeah. As I put in my pieces, adjusted for adjustments.
Yeah.
So, yes, once you do all that and dot the I's and cross the T's, it's 1% growth. And on the quarter, it was 4% growth.
Yeah, which is quite good.
Yeah, it's pretty solid across the board, the network side of things.
I still don't believe in this adjustment.
No?
No.
Well, it's usually currency movements.
Yeah, no, but most of the time they say, okay, well, but they never bring it up when it's good.
No, well, it's moving it the other way.
No.
So their growth 10%, but it's only 4% on.
So in this case, the adjustments.
The reported number's 10%, they're up. They're up a tenth. So they're actually sort of saying, well, hang on a minute, that's largely to do with currency movements in our favour.
Okay.
You take those out and it's
only 4%. Well, it's very rare that they actually say, turn an executive sitting around and say, oh, actually, you know, we did this amazing quarter, but it wasn't all because of us, it's because of the financial markets. But they're very
adjustments
quick
is rubbish
to blame when it's brought them down.
Yeah, I suppose. But it's the same with kind of Vodafone today. It's kind of quite sharply down, but I think it's mainly to do with they've sold a business. You know, they've had they've sold Qatar. Which
it was
is
mainly to
business.
Do with change in
And there's a change
accountancy,
in accounting regulation.
Accountancy regulation,
so it's the sale of a business, which is obviously going to wipe a lot off. And then
I don't think it was a massive. It was a Qatar business.
You guys just
it?
Messing still, with all
still,
my sequence.
It's still a percentage of revenue.
Yeah, but it's not. It's not going to be.
But
significant, but
in principle, you could sell a business and it's going to get rid of a fifth of your revenue.
But the problem,
buy one and it adds that on.
But so. To counter that, though, they haven't added on the Vodafone India business yet. So
that
reports its results.
Well, will they?
Because
that's divested, isn't it? That's a JV now.
Yeah, but it's still 51% of what it is owned by the Vodafone Group, isn't it? So it still contributes to.
I think organically
financials.
They were saying what flattish or 0.1 or something.
For
is
what?
Right?
For Vodafone India?
No, Vodafone Group.
Service
revenues is about 0.1 or something.
Well, so. I mean, it's all nuanced because they're actually, if you go year on year with this accounting standard, they're 800 million down.
Yeah.
So, you know, that's obviously a huge chunk of change, but it's because of the way that they register revenue in the financial, I mean, basically, they're blaming the accountants for year-on-year decline.
But Ericsson is up a lot, and if you just want to ignore the organic thing, then it's up a tenth, basically.
Yeah, well, so I think the point, I think I agree with Jamie when it comes to how they spin it, and they will choose to dwell on the adjustments when it suits them and not when they don't. I think the adjustments themselves are perfectly kosher. They're just an accounting thing. Mm. I don't think you can, honestly, with a public company, I don't think you really can dick about with numbers. It's just too out there. People
are going to call bullshit. I think you can, just mainly because of this this new IRFS.
Well, that's a one-off change, but the organic reported thing has been a long-running thing, and it's usually to do with currency. It's usually a currency thing where
the problem is you can't compare two companies now because some of them are on IRFS and the other ones are on IAF. Mm.
Well, that's annoying. Yeah,
so you can't actually compare the
no,
two.
No, I've always found that all that gap and non-gap stuff annoying as well. You want to be able to compare like for like. I think, you know, people who do this every day, as we're chatting about in the office, they will have spreadsheets and algorithms and ways of accounting for all these things.
Yeah.
But I suppose, Jamie, just to give Vodafone a bit of the benefit of the doubt, although I wasn't planning on going onto that one, but clearly all podcast discipline has disappeared since we last did it. If you're going to change the way you do your accounting, there is going to be some kind of one-off thing, be it positive or negative.
Yeah, of course.
Presumably, if it had been positive and they'd smashed it out of the park because of accounting, we'd be going, well, that's handy, isn't it? So I guess they've got to account for it at some stage. But anyway, back to Ericsson, if that's all right, you two, if you got that out of your system. So that was all quite solid. I was just having a little look at the individual segments. So you were just saying, Ian, that their digital services are done all right. Now, one thing we have to factor, so again, adjusted for adjustments, they've done all right, but then they've had to write off a great big chunk, haven't they?
Yeah, it's good on the sales front. I mean, the story with digital services is basically that's been the thing that's kind of weighed Ericsson down, the profitability level.
Yeah.
And it's been the most troublesome bit of the...
It's been the hardest the to turn around, hasn't it?
Yeah. And I think... Echo made the fair point that when he kind of came in, every single bit of it was loss making, I think,
right,
maybe even declining in sales. And I think the situation is they've managed to get most of the stuff working quite well and sorted out, and it's just this BSS part that's still.
And Echo just sort of went, do you know what, it's just not happening.
Well, they've still got BSS, but they've tried to come up with this platform.
Full stack
platform, where you get everything from Ericsson.
Sounds like some kind of new thing from McDonald's.
And
it hasn't
worked,
hash browns,
no one's basically gone for it. So they've had to basically, I mean, you covered this as well, because it was a couple of weeks ago, they kind of pre-announced it, where they've written off a huge amount.
Indeed.
For that, and that's really kind of eaten into the operating margin. But on the sales front, if you look at the Q4 performance, I think on digital services, it's really up a lot on top line. And I mean, we both spoke with their departing chief marketing officer, Helena Norman.
That's right.
She was saying to me that there's been quite a lot of uptick on, I think, on the BSS side in traditional products, the kind of stuff that
she's saying everything else is cool,
everything's cool, but
we're getting rid of,
they've got
well,
like
I suppose
about
you probably would say that.
300-350 customers, I think, using the stuff that kind of came before Revenue Manager, which is now all the investments going back into that area, and that seems to have done really well in the fourth quarter. So there's sort of, you can kind of see light at the end of the digital services tunnel for them.
Well, I think what they've done on the whole under Ekholm is, you know, under Vestberg, I think there were some grandiose, really ambitious projects, and let's do this.
They tried to diversify quite a
lot, obviously. But a hell of a lot of the big grand plans that they tried under him, Ekholm's just sort of got rid of.
Yeah.
And he just seems to be pruning it down and just going, look, let's just do the basics
well.
Got rid of a lot of staff, I know, and it has to be noted that for them to have their first sort of revenue growth in 6 years comes after a lot of revenue decline, obviously. Yeah. So, well, but I mean, it's still a reverse in momentum.
Than it was. I think, you know, they were on, I think there was a time they were sort of on about 250 SEK, you know, Swedish krona, but I don't know what that works out at, but I think the full year figure was about 210 for last year, so
yeah. Probably got that here.
But all that, like you say, all that media stuff, and I think they've sold some cloud.
210.8, go on, you smashing it out of the park.
I think they've sold like a lot of some cloud stuff, haven't they, as well? Cloud hardware assets they've sold.
Yeah, they tried to flog their media. Apparently the media services wasn't doing so well, and they haven't even completed that joint venture thing. So that's dragging their numbers down a bit. But yes, on the whole, I think I'm prepared to go with the narrative of, you know, a shift in momentum. Seems to be getting better. It's been three quarters in a row where it's been fairly solid. Quarterly. So
if it weren't for this this kind of snafu on the BSS side, then they'd have had an even kind of better sort of finish to the year. As it was, that kind of chewed into the margins a bit, didn't it?
Don't know what it says about. So they've had to write down all this stuff from the Vestberg era, and now we've just heard that Verizon's having to what is it, get rid of 7% of its workforce or
this
something
is
like
7%
right.
of yeah, media business
of
units.
Just the
this
media
is Oath, is it?
Oath, yeah.
Well,
I suppose
yeah.
we can't really pin that on Vesper, can we? All those acquisitions happened pre him.
Yeah, I mean they've been making a lot of call center layoffs as well. Verizon,
but that's a different business unit to Vesper, isn't it? I thought he was in charge of their.
Well, he's the overall.
He's the overall CEO,
overall CEO
now.
Oh right, yeah. Okay.
He came in to head up the networks,
he was
but
CTO,
now
but
that other lad's handing it over.
Lowell McAdam.
There we are.
Yeah. No, they got 7%. Yeah, 7% decline because it's just been a bloody disaster for them, start to finish. But I mean, that was after the write down, the $4.6 billion write down last month.
Yeah.
Which was, yeah, I mean, it's just.
But with Vestberg in charge, what could go wrong?
Yeah. Well, maybe Vestberg sort of learnt from, because, you know, he will have worked with Ekholm, because Ekholm was, you know, always a part of the non-exec.
Ericsson's doing quite well, isn't it, out of some.
Yeah, so maybe he's learnt. He's going for the whole, right, let's just cull the dodgy stuff.
Yeah.
I mean, there's another tangent with that Verizon thing, which is digital media, which is what we do for our day job. I was reading some other articles, The Guardian's written about it, some of the podcasters I listen to talk about it. There's a fair bit of carnage
going.
What
do you mean, sort of reporters and stuff?
Yeah, just a lot of layoffs across digital media, full stop. BuzzFeed's laying off a ton of people. Obviously, the ones that are part of Verizon, which includes Huffington Post, are having a nightmare. It's, you know, I'm not that surprised, because I think, just to indulge this little tangent briefly, because it's really hard to make money through straight up ad sales on digital media.
Yeah.
You know, in the B2B stuff that we do, we got a slightly different business model and a more bespoke offering, which I think to some degree shields us from the pressures that people that just rely on raw traffic for their money, like Huffington Post or BuzzFeed, are under. But they all seem to be having a nightmare. Obviously, they've lost a hell of a lot of their total addressable market to Facebook and Google and big platforms. And I expect that to continue. I mean, I don't get any pleasure from seeing other media go under.
No, it's worrying, really.
But I'm not surprised by it because it's just really hard to extract money from digital traffic unless you've got a bespoke offering like us where you've got a very distinct audience and then people want to access that audience.
Yeah, or if you've got a parent that...
As good a technology platform as the likes of Facebook or Twitter or Google... You know, if you're going to direct your advertising money somewhere, you go where you're going to get the best results, and the best results are the companies that have the best digital advertising platform, and that is Facebook, Google, Twitter, those companies. You know,
indeed.
You don't invest in the stack, and then you're not going to get the returns.
Well, Verizon was hoping that what it bought with Yahoo was a good digital marketing platform, but you can only assume from this sort of latest. Write down or this latest downsizing. That's not the case.
This is the problem I found is that, or from my perspective, I mean, it was a completely idiotic move because they're trying to capture the same advertising revenues, but they're not offering the same platform.
Mm.
You know, offering a media news content platform is not the same as going to a brand and saying you can advertise over social media or over search engine. You know, it's a different proposition, so you're going to get different buying needs, and there's not going to be anywhere near as much advertising revenue directed towards the news content platforms as, you know, a search engine or a social media platform. So they said they wanted to go capture, you know, steal some of this revenue, but they haven't bought a platform which is even capable of. You know, it's not even the same game.
No, it does seem to be, and it's hard to see given what a massive lead the digital platforms, social media, etc., have over them, what they're going to do about it. But anyway, that's an interesting thing there. The other angle, which leads to a sort of a bit of a segue to other stuff about Ericsson, there was Börje Ekholm was interviewed at Davos. Mm. This sort of bizarre studio that's outside. Actually, I asked Helena about it on the call. She said, "Yeah, those studios actually were outside." But But what cracked me up about it is everyone was sitting there with 12 coats on, and you could see their breath in this apparent TV studio. It just seemed really odd. And the reporters were trying to get.
This is when he was asked about Huawei, yeah.
Exactly, yeah. And so that was the angle they were going for.
He had the same question today on the earnings call.
Yeah, exactly. And I directed that at Helena in the full knowledge that she would give me a similar response. But she did, I thought, deflect quite effectively in one direction, which is to point out, so you know you got that Dell'Oro market share thing. That's what I was asking you about earlier. That they have gained about a percentage point of Dell'Oro. And over time they've gained it. And her point was that their market share gains...
I think that's product-driven though, isn't it, really? It's
well,
not,
quite.
Yeah.
But it's still share of the market.
Yeah.
So in principle, you know, all the journalists were trying to ask the question, is because Huawei's getting such a hard time for everyone, are you benefiting from it?
Yeah.
Now, one way in which that benefit could have manifested itself would be a market share increase, presumably, as people in countries like Australia bail out.
I think that market share increases has come because of ZTE.
Right.
In fact, if you look at Dell'Oro's numbers, then ZTE had quite a sharp... because clearly it stopped operating effectively.
Yeah.
So you had companies like Wind in Italy having to use Ericsson, for example.
Right.
To bring them
in. Yeah, I think you're onto something there. But her counterpoint, and you feel free to disagree with that, I just want to finish representing it before you do, was that the market share increase has been reasonably steady over time, which points more towards just a sort of normal, sustainable, meritocratic growth rather than because of one-off external thing. But,
well, I don't think they would have. Yeah, I mean, the numbers don't point to any kind of, you know, everybody's kind of jumping from Huawei to Ericsson all of a sudden, and it wouldn't show up anyway, really, because it's just too soon. It's only in the last three or four months that it started to happen.
That's a good point.
So, but clearly, if Huawei is locked out of these markets, you know, like today, the stuff about, or yesterday, late, I don't know when, but about, you know, Poland. There's now.
What's the latest on that? I might have missed that.
So,
I mean, I know we had that bloke arrested.
Reuters reported that the government officials they'd spoken with were saying that a ban against Huawei in the 5G market is almost as good as done. It's just they're just doing the sort of paperwork on it, basically.
So, and has Poland got the arsehole on the back of that story from a week or two ago?
That was the main reason. They arrested someone, didn't they? They actually arrested a Huawei employee for spying.
Indeed.
So. These officials were, and they're quoted. They're not. It's not like sources. They're actually people.
They've just come out and gone. No, we're not having this.
Yeah, and then the latest today, which you know, I think Vodafone's CEO Nick Reed had said this morning to some journalists, probably when they were talking about the trading update, that they've paused investment in Huawei core network stuff in their market.
Oh, I missed that.
Yeah, they used it in Spain and some other smaller European markets, and they've
did paused. He say why?
Because they're kind of worried about the security backlash. They need to talk to government officials and find out what's going on.
So that's part of the contagion. Even if Vodafone themselves don't think it's dodgy, they don't want to be in a situation where countries they operate
I think it's mainly the worry what's happening on the regulatory side, isn't it? And that's probably why BT's had this policy in place for a long time. Because it's the Vodafone move is very similar to BT's, where they're basically taking out of the core, which is the intelligent bit of the network and the sensitive part. But, you know, keep it in the dumb radio gear, that's okay.
Yeah.
And obviously BT has figured, you know, a long time ago that there could always be a security regulatory concern about using, you know, a Chinese supplier in that bit of the network. And
yeah, because it's not like Western sort of ambiguity towards China's a new thing, is it?
Exactly. But if this happens and it carries on like snowballing the way it is, then obviously Ericsson's going to pick up some business because there's not a lot of other people to use. You're not going to use ZTE because they're going to be banned as well. There's only Ericsson and Nokia, really. I mean, Samsung's, you know, a bit of a presence now that it, you know, didn't used to be. It's a bit more active in that market, but you kind of got limited options, really.
Yeah. Obviously,
Ekholm doesn't want to stir the pot and start.
That's it.
You know,
I think that's what
comments,
I was giving him credit
but
more. Obviously, everything you say rings true. I just find it interesting as a journalist to see how these execs deflect these questions.
Yeah.
And you know what they most don't want is for us to be able to run on the headline such as Ericsson CEO cusses Huawei.
Well, I asked her the other way around. I said, have you seen any retaliation in China? You know, because there's this worry now that Nokia and Ericsson, if we're going to lock Huawei out, then they'll kind of retaliate. But she's very, she sort of deflected it. You know, she's very good at not getting involved in those sorts of discussions. So,
well, I've got there.
I think they make about
20%
of their revenues, don't they?
I've got this
Northeast
here.
Northeast Asia.
So what? Is Northeast Asia include
Northeast
China?
Northeast Asia includes China, and they don't break out China, but I think it's about 12% of their sales come from Northeast Asia.
Right, yeah, well, it's,
And
8.4 out of 63.8, so that sounds about right. But the interesting thing there is the growth. The year-on-year growth in Northeast Asia was 30%.
Right.
That's their biggest region for growth. The next biggest region for growth is North America.
Yeah.
And then it's relatively minor growth.
Well,
and
Northeast Asia would cover a lot of these markets, I guess, that are starting to spend now on 5G equipment.
Korea, and Japan.
Yeah, I'm guessing, sort of, yeah.
And then Southeast Asia, Oceania and India. They have a weird group. Europe and Latin America. I know it's because they've got one chap in charge of it all, and they've got.
Well, I know the reason for that.
Oh yeah, go on.
So it's because one of their big customers is Telefonica.
Yeah.
In fact, I think the biggest customer is Telefonica.
Yeah. Well, I always figured that
it was
a Telefonica
link. And they
operate
across Europe and Latin America.
Quite.
So it just makes sense to have that from a.
God, you know your big customer when they arrange their whole geographical sort of listing.
Yeah.
So that's still that's their biggest, but that only grew by 8%. Middle East and Africa shrunk by 14%.
Yeah, there's apparently some geopolitical issues in Africa at the moment. That
always bloody is, isn't
there? There always are. Yeah, so.
So back to the Huawei thing. We might as well just go full on that. So there've been a few things going on this week. Again, Davos. We had Huawei took the opportunity to sort of have a bit of a moan and just go, why doesn't
they sort of suggested that they're going to kind of go back to their Asian roots, didn't they? And
well, there
if
was,
you're going to be like that to us, we'll just become smaller.
Yeah, I quite like that one as well. There was the bit where it was like, well, we'll go where we're welcome.
Yeah, exactly.
And it's just like, it's slightly petulant, wasn't it?
Yeah.
But also, taking the petulance aside, you know, they got a sort of point. It's like, all right, we'll just... I think what they're trying to say is, you know, the world doesn't centre on you. This is the slightly worrying thing about when we get into this sort of protectionist stuff, is you can see how it escalates.
Yeah.
So, you know, we come up with some rhetoric against China, again, you can't really trust them not to do espionage. And then they go back and it just escalates and escalates. It becomes like a sort of playground fight. I think that's why markets
this worry that these Canadian citizens who've been arrested in China recently, it's all in retaliation.
Yeah,
for the
some guy had been found guilty of drug dealing and they just sentenced unilaterally upgraded his sentence to death.
That's not
uncommon if you actually look at the stats. I think China, there's no official statistics on how many people they execute a year, but the UN
they lose count.
Yeah, but the UN estimates that China executes more prisoners per year than the rest of the world combined.
Right.
So you know, upgrading it to upgrading the sentence of execution is not uncommon.
No, and I don't know the whole story, but it was easy to, in the context of everything we've been talking about, to interpret that as some kind of. As it being affected by the geopolitical situation.
Let's not become the Daily Mail. Let's not make assumptions
I'm not saying I am making the assumption. I'm just saying you can see why some people would.
Well, I think it's several,
some people
it's
less
several
balanced and objective.
It's several Canadians, isn't it, that have been arrested?
And that's all kicking off. And Canada must feel a little bit annoyed because this is all done at the behest of the Yanks anyway.
I think on sort of dodgy grounds, the Canadian arrests a couple of them.
Right.
A bit like this guy who got arrested in, you know, Abu Dhabi or whatever, or Dubai, was it? No, it wasn't. What am I talking about?
Are you talking about the British
university? British guy got arrested, for a spy, allegedly spying in, I think it was Abu Dhabi,
research.
Wasn't it? Yeah.
UAE.
This is trumped up charges, Abu Dhabi.
I know. Well, we've got our former podder, Tim Skinner, still lives out there.
He's in Dubai.
I hope he's not taking any photos of stuff he shouldn't be. But yes, no, my feeling is, notwithstanding the fact that I know people who live out there and apparently have no aggro at all, there's certain places, I don't think I'd travel to China now.
No.
I'd just feel nervous about suddenly being met at the airport by some guys in a uniform.
Especially all the things you've written about Huawei. Yeah. You'd be top of their list, Scott.
They've
already got your name on a sheet of paper.
I don't think I'm any more horrible about Huawei than I'm anyone else. I'm probably on a few lists. I'd feel nervous about going there, just in case you got caught in, you know, as a bit of a...
One executive that I spoke to at our light reading event in Lisbon said he would be nervous about travelling to China at the moment. Can't say what company's from because he's sort of speaking in confidence.
Yes,
but
of course.
Sort of...
Is it from Verizon? AT&T? Colt?
We're going to go through a
Comcast? Bell? Yeah.
No, it's not on the service provider side.
Oh, yeah. Was it Nokia?
Right, how long are we going to do this for?
It was Ericsson, wasn't it?
What else has been going with the Huawei thing? So yeah, they were chatting at Davos. They tried to get Ekholm to talk about it, and he wouldn't. It's not obvious to see an end in sight with this Poland. You know, you expect every new week to affiliated to the
and
US.
And I think the mainstream press now, the Reuters and Bloomberg guys, have obviously got their teeth into this and are just going to sort of keep at it, aren't they? It's an opportunity whenever Huawei is at an event to go and ask them about it. It's an opportunity to go and ask government officials about this all the time. So it almost makes the story bigger than it is, because every little hint that an official gives where, we're a bit concerned about Huawei, well, they might have said that 5 years ago, but in the context of what's going on, it sounds like a ban's imminent. So.
Yeah, and operators are gonna be, as we were just talking about with Vodafone, are going to be cautious, not because they necessarily have got any concerns about Huawei themselves, but because they think that their regulators or governments might just unilaterally go, no, you can't do that.
Yeah.
I tell you, actually, one thing I was thinking about the flip side of Huawei, I thought they actually had some quite strong announcements this week, which was probably a welcome bit of positive publicity for them. So, yeah, they launched a new mobile device chip.
Right.
You know, so to take on the likes of...
This is a processor, is it?
Yeah. So the modems theirs.
Yeah.
So they even do their own modems. They've been doing their own application processors for a while, but then serve Apple and lots of people. But Huawei's now doing their own modem, and
this would allow them to stop using, because this is interesting in light of the possible speculation they could get banned from acquiring US components like ZTE was last year.
Quite.
And they're a bit more self-sufficient, I think, than ZTE, aren't they? But this is a step towards becoming even more self-sufficient, I guess.
I think so, yeah. I thought
that's what what's his name said in the pre-Christmas message that they sent out. So they had, what is it, before they had the CEO, who is it? Is it Ken Hood at the moment?
Yeah, yeah.
Who's the CEO? So he did a pre New Year's message. And then I think it was, is it Ping that's the executive chairman?
Right.
Liang, I think. That's what I was writing about. Well, a chairman. Yeah. He was talking at Davos.
Post New Year's, they said one of their big things is to make their supply chain more resilient.
Right.
And for me, that just said less dependent on the US.
Yeah.
Because, yeah, you're right. You know, precedent dictates that if they're caught violating trade sanctions, they have to face the same punishment as their TE, because it's the same crime.
Yeah.
So they're going to, you know, in theory, they should get banned from... of course, this is all dependent on whether they actually find Meng guilty in the first place.
Yeah, or even extradite her. They haven't even done that yet.
Well, I mean, no, they don't have to extradite her. If she's tried in Canada and found guilty of violating trade sanctions, it doesn't need to be in a US court, because then that's still justification to say you violated our trade sanctions.
But if the US wants to try her, don't they have to do it in the US?
But why can't the Canadians try her?
Oh, well, I don't know if that's the plan.
I don't know.
Canada's just holding on to her. Just obviously rather sort of like, God, can someone just deal
so she
with
got
this?
Like an ankle bracelet, and she's got a house in Vancouver, hasn't she? Or
yeah, so she, yeah, I think she's got some kind of you're on bail, but you're not allowed to leave the country
under house arrest kind of thing.
She's staying in a nice apartment somewhere.
She's got a nice house.
She owns properties there.
She owns half of Vancouver, course, probably.
Obviously.
She spends a lot of time in Canada.
She's staying with TELUS.
Yeah.
yeah, I think so.
But it's irrelevant. I mean, I don't know whether they plan on pressing charges, but it's irrelevant whether
they said they will.
Where she gets.
Yeah. Assuming it's the Yanks that want to try her, I figure they've got to get her over the border.
So anyway. Which prison will she go to? Canadian prison?
Right.
Well, it depends.
It doesn't sound too bad.
It depends who tries her.
Yeah. Yeah, Canadian prisons, they're probably really mellow, aren't they?
Yeah.
Everyone just
cable TV
weaving and that sort
smoking
of thing.
Like Tunney and goes up a mountain walks, yeah.
That's exactly all that's
quite nice. Thing. Maybe I should get arrested in Canada.
Yes. Well, there we go.
Get some pressure.
So this chip, yes, I mean, obviously there's the supply chain implication, but it's also just a general competitive thing. You know, Huawei's one of the few companies in the world that has the expertise and the funds and the wherewithal to become, because there's not many people make modems.
Is this because they have their own chip subsidiary, don't they? Is it Hisense or?
Hisense, yeah.
Yeah.
But that was always application processes. Oh, right. Maybe they did do modems. I haven't kept totally.
No, I'm not saying that they did. I'm just wondering, is that the bit that's developed this new modem, or is it?
Yeah, although they didn't talk about that branding in the press release, actually. Because if you think about it, in terms of modems, right now, like Apple has had to switch to Intel because it's pissed off with Qualcomm. So that's how little choice there is. Intel, I mean, Intel's fine, but most people consider them to be behind Qualcomm in terms of this stuff. So that makes them one of the few players where they're planning to get involved in getting third parties to do it. But then the another thing they said in this same announcement is that they expect to become the number one smartphone vendor within a year or two, overtake Samsung.
Wow.
So they're number two
well,
now.
Well, if there's more Jamies around, then they'll be all right.
Yes, indeed.
Well, that entirely depends on where the ban is going to come from as well, because if there is a ban, they can't use Androids, and I strongly suspect that this operating system they're building in-house won't be anywhere near as good.
Yeah,
then all
true.
Of a sudden, their phone sales go off a cliff.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, one thing that should be spelt out, because this comes up quite a lot, like when I'm listening to Joe Rogan or whatever and Huawei comes up, until recently he only really understood Huawei as a smartphone maker. He didn't understand them as the biggest kit vendor in the world. And most of these bans primarily apply to being involved in networking equipment. Now, granted, in the States, I think public sector, they're banned from having Huawei phones as well. You know, they don't want people in the army getting tapped into and stuff.
But as Jamie says, if they can't use US components, that would include software as well. So they won't be able to use
the
Android.
The SETI ban was everything.
So it affected their ability
as well. Yeah, okay.
They couldn't export any components or IP.
So it's components that go in your handsets.
Couldn't even export some jeans. Yeah, all right, understood. Fair enough. Yeah, no, that would be catastrophic.
And that's the fastest growing bit of their business, isn't it, the handsets?
Yeah, apparently it's 52 billion.
52.
I can't remember where I read that, but apparently it's 52 of 109 billion.
Right.
The only thing I'll say, by the way, about Android and banning it is open source. So even if you banned it, you know, there will be copies of Android and there will be forked versions of Android kicking about all over the place. And I don't think they would have the jurisdiction to go in China and say you can't use these versions of Android. Then it just becomes a commercial matter with Google, and they can block people from the Play Store and all that sort of thing if they fork the versions of Android. So I can't imagine a time where they couldn't use the Android operating system. But yes, other things like
Qualcomm's
screens
chips
or
and stuff,
Qualcomm's chips or whatever the other components, then yes, I'm sure.
I mean, a lot of people who get Huawei phones, they wipe it out and install a clean version of Android.
Right.
A lot of people do that.
Okay. Your hacker mates.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Technically.
Install a French version of Android.
Yeah.
What was I? There was one more thing I was going to say. Oh yeah, talking about phones, they also threatened to launch a foldable phone at Mobile World Congress.
Dear.
I thought there's a sort of quick little tangent we could talk about. Jamie and I were having a quick chat about this earlier. So they're going to do it. Samsung's been banging on about bendable screens forever. When I was at Strategy Analytics, that was the thing they were briefing people on, and before then, so at least 10 years. But now it looks like they're finally arriving, and so I guess the thinking behind a foldable phone is that you get a regular phone like this, but it's clamped shut, and then you can open it up and have double the screen real estate.
No, bent around the back.
I was showing, look.
It's bent around the back.
Okay.
No, this is the Xiaomi one that was showing Jamie earlier.
Yeah, so it's bent around the back. So, the one you showed.
So the screen wraps around the whole thing.
I'll show it
closed.
On screen
it's
right now.
On the back, and it's like a device like that, and then you open it up, so it's got wings on the sides, which makes it into more of an entertainment
fair
device.
Enough.
So it's not actually clamped shut. It's so you can function as a phone like this. Then if you want it as a video device, you just open up
it's like
wings.
Sort of, it's like folding out a table or something.
Or you can watch TV more easily.
Yes, yes. So I think it's bridging the gap between...
I'll show it on the screen,
Sort of smartphone devices and entertainment devices.
What do we think about that as an idea?
I think that sounds quite good. If it's done well, I think it could sound quite... Sounds quite good, actually.
I think that's where the industry is going to evolve to anyway. I think these are communications devices. These are communications devices, but ultimately you've got to look at market trends. Gaming and video is becoming massive, so you've got to adapt devices or create devices that are more applicable to two applications.
Have you seen it?
No, to me this is the best application.
Bored of waiting. Okay.
But I still don't get it. That's pretty good, isn't it?
A lot of people
are using their devices nowadays as entertainment devices, not communications devices.
Are you going to cut away to a clip?
So you've got to actually develop a device which meets market demand. And market demand is watching video at the moment. How many people actually make phone calls
watching
nowadays?
Porn in India, apparently.
Yeah. Was it?
India's levels of data traffic since Jio came in and said you can have it for free have like spiked. And there's an article in The Economist this week that basically it's all porn. Yeah. It's basically Indian guys on buses.
I'm so shocked.
And they would do it in public places. They just watch porn videos.
Damn.
So.
But yeah, but that's what I think. I think you know, eventually we'll get to a certain point where you know, the smartphone becomes somewhat redundant because you'll be able to do everything through gesture control and voice control. Therefore, do you actually need a screen to text people when it can read back text to you?
Right.
And you can write text through voice control.
And we all have little Bluetooth things embedded in our ears.
Yeah, but maybe these will actually evolve into entertainment devices, not communications devices. And then the communications is an afterthought, which you control without even having to take it out of your pocket.
Arguably, you could say that transition's underway right now. I find it interesting when I get a train into London, just watching what people do while they're commuting. So I tend to read and listen to music, but most people I've noticed are either watching video or playing games.
Yeah.
On the commute in.
Yeah, people don't read anymore, Scott. I mean,
no.
That's
so nice. People I read, well, I'm special.
So 20th century.
Quite.
Audiobooks. Just listen to a book. Yeah.
Takes so much longer, though.
Yeah, I guess so. Well, no, you can read, you can listen as you're walking, though. To read, you have to be sitting down.
Yeah.
Where is that? And I'm noticing even more incident while you're talking about that of people just not looking up while they're walking along the street while they're looking at their smartphone.
Yeah,
just
that is
not
very
looking
irritating.
Up.
It's
just
so
assuming that the Red Sea, is the Red Sea is going
to
part for them.
Yeah. I find that really winds me up, actually.
Yeah. And I'm like, all right, how about I don't move?
Yeah.
You just want to go like that, like smack their phone down. Oh, sorry. Didn't see you there.
So that's that. Right. So you guys started on Vodafone earlier. And I wrestled back control. I'll now relinquish it once more. So just give us a little recap about the quarterlies, and then you've been looking at some other stuff to do with Vodafone as well, haven't you, Jamie?
Yeah. I mean, the quarterly figures, they look okay. You know, it's not exactly nosediving, but it's not exactly setting the world on fire. Africa is growing. Vodacom, I think the only negative there was South Africa. India hasn't been reported yet. And then across Europe, you got most of the markets in decline, but there's heavy, heavy competition everywhere. And Germany is growing as well as their other European segments. But, you know, they're such minor businesses all clumped together. So there is moderate growth across the business, but some of its marquee markets are really struggling in Europe.
Yeah.
I mean, my big issue is that, first of all, it's got a lot of exposure in terms of upcoming spectrum auctions.
You wrote a piece about that, didn't you?
Yeah, there's a lot of it's going to have to spend a lot of money to get premium assets in the remaining markets.
It's already
markets.
Spent quite a lot in Italy.
It's already spent quite a lot, and ultimately, you know, the trends are, and you're keeping track of all this. The trends are that spectrum is increasing in price with every auction that goes bust. So the further you know, unless this trend starts faltering, it's going to get more and more expensive as time goes on. The second issue I'm finding with Vodafone at the moment is that they haven't got a cash cow to rely on. When you look at any of the big European operators, they generally have a cash cow in their domestic market and then can use that safety net to expand across Europe. So when you look at Telefonica, it's dominant in Spain and it's the market leader in the UK and Germany for mobile, so it can rely on that and then expand elsewhere. KPN is a market leader in the Netherlands, and then it can look to expand elsewhere. TIM in Italy, you know, that is the go-to strategy, and you know, it's pretty much everyone, like Tele2 in Sweden, Telia in Finland. You know, they are market leaders, and then look to expand elsewhere. The problem with Vodafone at the moment is that it hasn't really got that cash cow that you can rely on.
It's about third in the UK.
You know, it's third in the UK. It's not number one in Germany. It's not number one in Spain. It's not number one in Italy. It is number one in Africa, but Africa, the market dynamics there are completely different to everywhere else in the world.
Yeah.
So I'm going to discount that for the moment.
Vodafone Idea is number one, but all the momentum is with Reliance Jio. The issue with Vodafone, it's fighting and it's a challenger in so many markets. And you've got to think there's got to be some battle fatigue somewhere.
Easy money anyway.
There's no easy money. And every other one of the telcos, which is operating on the international markets, has this reliable source of income in their home market. I mean, admittedly, there are other examples like Three, which is a challenger business in pretty much every market it operates in. But the way Three is structured, it's developed a business model which helps it be a challenger.
Yeah, that's part of its thing. Yeah.
The big traditional telcos are, the way they're structured is that they need a cash cow and then that reliability before it then can go expand into new markets. So this is where I think Vodafone is really putting itself in a precarious position, and ultimately it's fighting back in the UK. I think the convergence play that it's going for is, you know, could be a good offering. I think they are making gains in the mobile space.
Yeah, the UK seems like quite a good market for it at the moment, I suppose.
Have you been covering the...
I haven't covered the results today. Okay. I've not really looked at them. I'm sort of vaguely aware of stuff that's going on with them. But like Jamie says, they always seem to have some issues in somewhere. And at the moment, from what we can see over the last few weeks, the big problem seem to be Spain and Italy in Europe, because Italy, they've kind of been hammered by Iliad's entry, as everybody has. And they've spent a huge amount on spectrum as well, which Nick Reed had come out and kind of moaned about. And in Spain, it's just gone really, really badly wrong. They've just kind of been clobbered by convergence competition from Orange and Vodafone.
Right. And they got a very buoyant MVNO market in Spain.
And they're
cutting
a quarter of staff in Spain, 1,200 jobs, they said a couple of weeks ago, are going to go. So because the performance hasn't been good. So, and then this kind of cost cutting, you know, trying to get the business a lot leaner and, you know, start, you know, just operate everything with fewer people just seems to be a kind of big Vodafone theme at the moment.
Well, and as we were chatting about earlier, a big theme in general.
Yeah, definitely.
Quite a lot of this going on.
The Vodafone thing, you can see why.
Yeah.
You know, if you put an accountant in charge, the overall business strategy is going to be more geared towards operational efficiency and making the spreadsheets look better, because that's what this business leader knows. That's his bread and butter. Mm-hmm. Admittedly, you know, I'm probably not giving Nick Reed a lot of credit there, because anyone who rises to the rank of CEO is going to be an incredibly intelligent person. So he's going to know other factors, but his bread and butter is operational efficiency and making the spreadsheets look fantastic.
Yeah.
So that it's little surprise that their business is heading that direction.
Yeah, but they made. I remember Jamie and I went to their doing Newbury last year when they were talking about 5G. One of the interesting things they did there was give an update on this chatbot Toby, which is their kind of, you know, AI system for dealing with customer queries. And they made a big thing about rolling this. It's been developed kind of in the UK, and they made a big deal about kind of extending this into other markets now. And you look at the kind of staff, you know, cutbacks that have been happening, a lot of this is on the customer care side, not just at Vodafone, but kind of telcos generally. You know, we talk about automation a lot in light reading in the kind of network side of things, but a lot of the attrition's kind of happening with customer care jobs, and that's something you see everywhere. You look at what's going on in the US. I mean, we were talking about Verizon earlier making, you know, cuts to jobs at at Oath, but there's been huge amounts of jobs going in customer care operations there at AT&T, and it's just going to kind of carry on, I think.
And why do you think they're cutting customer care?
Because it's just easy to cut. It's just easy to cut, isn't it?
It's easy to replace.
If you talk to the telcos themselves, some of them have come out and said, you know, customers don't want to talk to customer service assistants.
Right.
They don't want to go into shops anymore to buy phones. They want to order it and have it delivered. They don't want, you know, they want to do everything through messaging. If you've got a query, go onto a messaging platform and get it resolved. AI system can handle that.
We get quite a lot of webinars on telecoms.com that are specifically about AI-driven sort of customer care stuff.
This is one of the areas where AI is really starting to have a big impact on the workforce. You know,
the issue of whether AI will
claim jobs across the whole economy is another one.
But whenever you bring it up, they get really defensive.
They do. But it's clearly happening. You can see it happening. So.
And I suppose since the start of the year, there've been a few other little, slightly negative portents. Apple had a sort of earnings.
Nokia's cutting quite a lot of jobs.
Yeah, they've just cut about another 350, haven't they? Which
I mean, for me, we shouldn't be surprised about this at all. I mean, let's be completely cold blooded about this and take the sentiment out of it. What are telcos striving to do at the moment? They are attempting to reorganise their business so they can be competitive in the digital era, because 90% of these business models are dated and not suitable to compete with the OTTs and capture the more relevant, blossoming digital revenues.
Yeah.
Now, you have to cut away the shit if you're going to create a good business, because these guys who have been working for the company and working under this business model, 99% of the time do not have the right skills to adapt to a completely new business model. I mean, that, you know, if you take away all the sentiment about how you've got to feel sorry for these people, for these telcos to continue and to be to be competitive in the future, they have to fundamentally change their building blocks, and the building blocks of the business is its staff, and you know they're not relevant nowadays.
Yeah.
So what do you do when you're not relevant? You change, and what do you change? You change the people. So that is where if you're going to be completely cold hearted.
Yeah,
about
I mean you
it,
can re- you can obviously retrain them as an alternative.
Let's be completely honest.
I think they'll just need fewer people, though. That's the thing.
Right.
I mean, Jamie's right. Some people can't be. You know, it's hard to. I mean, Vodafone made this thing about offering staff training opportunities to customer care assistants and trying to get them to become developers. Do you remember that?
That's the big thing.
For a start, you don't need as many developers as you do customer care assistants, and also a lot of them are just people that wouldn't adapt to that kind of role.
Yeah,
I suspect, or might not want to do it. And
that's the very question you've got to ask. Is you've got to say, and this is a bigger question, and this goes back to, you know, the curriculums at school level, or the advice that kids are being given when they choose higher learning courses, or what to do in terms of sort of MVQs and that sort of thing. Is you've got to say, all of these companies are moving towards a more of a software orientated business model, something which is heavily can capitalize on big data and can capitalize on us becoming more virtually orientated. Now, these people who are in customer services, are they qualified to do these jobs?
Yes.
Yeah.
And 99% of the time it's no. So you can, it gets good PR inches, and it gets some positive news when people like Vodafone turn around and say we're going to retrain a load of people.
Yeah.
But I think it's absolute bullshit. I mean, it is not. And if they do try and do this, they will fail, because 99% of these people aren't software engineers.
They've got to be more decisive and just do the wholesale change.
Well, I suppose they're trying to. It's probably going to happen anyway that those people are going to go. They're trying to put the nice charitable, you know, we're friendly face on it, aren't they? I guess, and not come across as, you know, cost cutting corporate. You know,
they're trying to put a friendly face on an incremental change.
Yeah.
Whereas, I mean, you know, sometimes you've just got to be the bad guy, cut your losses, make drastic changes, and then build the reputation up from the bottom again. I mean,
no, that's kind of what slightly more slowly what we were talking about with Ericsson. Ericsson deserves some credit for being decisive about cutting stuff.
Yeah,
and all that sort of thing. So yeah, I agree with you on the whole.
Well, I suppose it's, you know, if you don't come, I mean, they looked almost like they could. Not, I don't want to say go out of business, Ericsson, but people were talking about, is this the beginning of the end?
Right.
A couple of years ago.
Just
it was when Vestberg
ago.
Was, you
right.
know, when everything was really going bad.
Yeah.
Because you sensed there could be a possibility there was talk about them actually getting acquired, I think, by Cisco
Indeed.
At one stage, and then they did that tie up instead, which hasn't really
don't
worked out.
Don't mention Cisco.
But
hasn't happened at all.
I suppose if they did just sit still and try and, we can kind of get through this somehow, things would be worse than they are now, potentially. So even though it's cost them 20,000 employees, I think, over the last two and a half years, at least now they're kind of, that business looks like it's, you know, stable.
I think most of the problem is it looks stable because it's looked terrible over the last couple of years, but I think it's outside factors that are making it look stable. Like you said before, you know, how much of Ericsson's success is down to Huawei's failings.
Huawei and ZTE not being allowed to play.
But with the telcos restructuring their business,
it looks okay because they're doing just as well or just as badly as their direct competitors. But when you compare it to the parallel industry of the OTTs and you see how much they're flying, the telcos are failing, and they're failing very badly. You know, it looks okay because of direct comparisons, but these guys have ambitions to evolve into new segments and create and capture new revenues. But when you compare it to the guys that are already in that space, they're in a different league. So this is where this is. Yeah. I mean, that is the counterpoint.
Well, I got one, but we're running out of time. I got a more positive note to end on. It just suddenly occurred to me. So there have been a lot of layoffs. There are all these challenges that you quite rightly identify. But I thought I'd mention this partly because we were going to get the person who was going to talk about it on the podcast last week if we'd been able to do one. A lady called Jennifer, who's one of the co-founders of a software company called
Pierre hadn't been on his 2 month holiday.
Yeah, he hadn't been sort of staying a bit longer at a snail farm. And so I thought I'd give it a mention. Jennifer, you didn't get on the podcast, sorry about that. But she, her company's done a little survey, about 4,000 people in the UK and the US, consumers, asking them what their expectations are of 5G. And she was quite surprised to find out that about a third of them really reckoned that 5G would sort out a lot of their sort of communications gripes they've got, of which are largely around coverage and bandwidth and all that. So, yeah, I know.
Are they mental?
Well, quite. But, you know, these are just consumers. You're asking. Clearly, it's not going to solve
coverage
issues.
It's like the T-Mobile survey that happened, which just raised some really weird things.
Well, I don't think they said... So
Jamie slams the microphone. It's not for me, it's for the listeners.
Yeah. Jamie's lick it.
I should represent their findings. So 33% of people said just generally they thought 5G would solve a lot of their communication problems. And then when they asked those 33% what their communication problems are, the biggest one was coverage. So you could read into that they think 5G is going to sort out the coverage problems, which is obviously a mistake.
I mean, not for me.
Everyone saw their coverage
problems.
They should just move to France or Spain, where coverage is a lot better.
Although there is that. Stop living in the middle of nowhere.
All that says to me is that people don't know what 5G is.
Yeah.
Well, there is that. Yes, I think all these things are fine.
They got no understanding of what the rollout is going to, how long it's going to take.
No, on the coverage side, you're obviously completely right. But on the flip side,
make coverage worse because they'll start investing in 5G in hotspots rather than spending money on 4G improvements.
No one's saying that 5G is a coverage play.
Yeah.
But I'd say the flip side to that, if you're just trying to gauge general sentiment, however uninformed or ill-informed it might be, the fact that a third of those surveyed just reckon some good stuff was going to come out of 5G. The reason I'm saying it's a positive point is because that's a market that these operators that are struggling to digitally transform and do all that sort of thing, you know, it's there. That was the point that Matrix wanted to make from it. Obviously, their vested interest is that they produce software that helps operators do this. But that doesn't mean that their point isn't valid, regardless of their commercial ulterior motive. So, you know, the opportunity's there. A third of people in the US and the UK are receptive to being sold 5G if you can just find the right way of selling it to them, be that bundling services with it or whatever. And a bunch of them in the survey said they'd be willing to pay for it as well.
Eventually they'll get it because it'll just be the de facto thing that you get. This is what happened with 4G. You'll get a few early adopters who go, "Oh, I want 4G because it's like having a better car than my neighbour. I've got a 5G connection."
Yeah.
You're still on 4G.
You'll always have early adopters.
Don't know what it means. And maybe there's some new phones that get released that are quite trendy, you know, that support 5G.
Foldy. So,
and then other people will just kind of go onto it because it's the latest technology, and operators, their main tariffs will be 5G ones.
Yeah, but there might be some other people whereby if you go, "I've got 5G and this is why it's good," and, you know, maybe package in a degree of, you know, access to streaming video or whatever.
If the limits go up, I suppose, if the data limits go up you know, something like that to make it appealing to
customers. That's what they're trying to say. It's only 4,000 people. It could be bollocks, but it's still a potential sort of area for operators to aim for if they want to get some quick ROI off their 5G investment.
Who were the respondents?
Just punters. People who've obviously already got phones, but that's everyone.
I'm not convinced by that research, to be honest.
Fair enough.
I'm not convinced.
Good company, that Matrix.
You can expect an email from Jennifer before.
Yeah, I don't know. There's a lot of other research going around from various houses that says that,
you know, 50% of people on the planet don't even know what bloody 5G is.
The planet, I mean, this is just US and UK.
Okay, but on the planet, you know, of people who will respond, who 90% of the time it is English-speaking countries, because they're English-speaking.
Yeah, well, there'll be lots of nuances surveys. To the survey. I mean, the fact is only a third of people reckon it'd be any good, so that means two-thirds of people, even if they have heard of it, don't think much of it, so that's the flip side of it.
I think there's been quite a lot of negative publicity about it in the mainstream press.
Helped by, like, AT&T and that bullshit, so we haven't had a chance to talk about that on the podcast.
But I remember even last year, the BBC's guy, what's his name, the tech guy at the BBC,
Jones.
You know, he was sort of, you know, 5G, it's not really that special, it's just, I mean, I've written stuff like this, to be honest.
It's good that people say that
actually, because it has been overhyped and it won't solve all these problems probably that it's supposed to, at least not
at
first.
But latency and robotic surgery.
Well, yeah, that's the exciting bit, but we don't see the evidence of it. So
no, but the problem is, I mean, yeah,
that's the potentially exciting bit.
But, what they have left out from that survey is that, I mean, places like the UK and Thingobob aren't fibred up to the teeth, so I mean, you can't really have 5G unless you're fibred up everywhere.
And we all agreed. So I met her last week in the office, and Ray came along as well, and we all agreed at the end of it that there's a major danger from over promising and I think we all can see that the industry is consistently guilty of overhyping.
She agreed with that as well,
but
she was compounding the issue with this survey.
Well, she was making a point with the survey that a third of those surveyed think 5G will be a good thing. I don't think that's the same as overhyping. But anyway, cool. Well, we've done about an hour, isn't it?
Yeah.
So, well done. We're back in the podcast
game. Good to be back.
Yeah. And and thanks everyone for listening. Make sure you join us for the next one, which will be done in less than a month.